Appreciated Andy mentioning the kingdom of heaven in the prayer just now. That is the point of interest for us as we are working our way through the parables just from that perspective. And that means that we're not looking at all the parables. We're looking at the ones that the stories Jesus told to try to give us some glimpse of what the nature and the character of the kingdom of heaven is. And we have already observed from the Gospel of Matthew that what he is talking about in this book with that phrase is not simply our ultimate home in heaven, but something very similar to what Jesus describes in the model prayer in Matthew 6. When he taught his disciples to pray, "Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." So the kingdom of heaven is the people in this world whose lives are lived under the rule of God. And it turns out in Matthew 16 that this phrase is a parallel for the idea of the church, which the Lord promised that he would build. So we kind of think of it in that way, then we get some idea of what is being compared to these things that are described in these little stories. Now, this one today is different in a couple of ways that I want to point out in the beginning. The first one is with regard to our phrase, the kingdom of heaven. This story does not start like the other parables do with the statement, "The kingdom of heaven is like," or "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to." In this case, please notice that down in verse 43, Jesus says, "Therefore I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits." So we find that in this case, the idea of the kingdom referred to more at the end of the story than at the first. So you kind of bear that in mind. And then notice in that statement I just read also, God looks for his kingdom to bear fruit actually in the lives of people. Fruit that are in keeping with God himself and what he wants. Fruits that are in keeping with God himself and what he wants. So that's the first way in which this story is a little different from the others. The second way that's interesting if you think about from a literary standpoint. All of you guys majored in literature, didn't you? From a literary standpoint, This parable is different from the others, from most of the others, in the sense that this one has more of an allegory type manner about it. We're taught that in a lot of the parables, not every detail in the parable is meant to have meaning, that you sort of mystically trace out somewhere in the recesses of the rest of the Bible. There was a stage in church history when the people became accustomed to allegorizing so that every detail and every parable had some sort of a hidden meaning to it. In some of the parables that we've been reading, I've been asking you to think about what is the one main point in this parable, and I think that's the right way to handle many of them. In this case, however, it is the case that almost every detail here has some sort of a parallel or a meaning to it that ties it with the rest of the Bible, and we know that because in this case, there are two passages of Scripture that Jesus quotes at the end of it to make the application. So in that way you'll notice that we have a little different sort of a, of an animal here to think about. Now, with that said, the practice that lies behind this picture that people heard Jesus would have been familiar with, that we may not be as familiar with, had to do with the way a landowner went about his business or conducting his business in the world at that time. A landowner, a master of a house in this case, hired for himself maybe what we would have called sharecroppers or tenant farmers, and he allowed them to work his place, if I can say it that way. And he would go, the landowner might go to some other place where he owned land. He might go on a long trip. He might go even out of the country. And then when the time for harvest came, he would send wanting his share or the price for their use of his property, of his land. And that would, of course, that was according to prior agreement. It was also quite reasonable. It was the obligation of the people who were using what they didn't own to provide fruit to the owner of the property. All right. Now that all makes sense. Now, remember the setting where we are here. We're at the last week of the Lord's life. This particular parable is set following the triumphal entry of Jesus and the cleansing of the temple and the beginning of the challenge of some of his enemies on where he got the authority to do those kinds of things. All right, it's becoming clear that Jerusalem has received its king, that God sent it, and that Jerusalem is going to be rejecting its king under the influence of the religious leaders. All right, that's maybe too much of the background, but that's the idea. You zoom out now, and the Lord is going to tell a story that helps the people understand how God has dealt with Israel, his covenant people, and how he will deal with them if they reject the king that he is sending to them. All right. That's the line of thought. Now, Matthew 21, verse 33, beginning. We need a reader for this passage. Fred, do you like to read? Or if you'd read verse 33, just read all the way down to the end of the chapter, if you would.
Hear another parable. There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it, dug a winepress in it, and built a tower. And he leased it to vine dressers and went into a far country. Now when vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the vine dressers that they might receive its fruit. And the vine dressers took his servants, beat one, killed one, and stoned another. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did likewise to them. Then last of all, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the vine dressers saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance. So they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine dressers? They said to him, he will destroy those wicked men miserably and lease his vineyard to other vine dressers who will render to him the fruits of their seasons. Jesus said to them, have you never read in the Scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken from you and given to a nation bearing the fruits of it. And whoever falls on this stone will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. Now when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parable, they perceived that he was speaking of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitude, because they took him for a prophet.
Thanks, Brad. Now you can see that in a way this passage here leads up to the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus. This passage leads partly to the arrangement with Judas to betray him secretly so it won't cause any trouble. And then it leads to their rejection of him. But it also leads to the rejection of Israel. And I wanted to study these two parables, one last week and this one, in order, because if you have the idea last week from Matthew 22, the first part, that king who threw the banquet for his son was just a petty fella who lost his temper because people didn't come and celebrate with his son. If he was just offended because they wouldn't come to his party, then this passage here might balance that out and to show that the judgment that this king brings against the people had to do with their aggressive mistreatment of him, of his grace, and not simply their slighting his invitation. So you can kind of see that as we think along here. Now, when you read this this parable, what is the one great big thought that jumps out to you from it? I'm going to see if the one that strikes me is the same one strikes you or not. What is the, when you read this parable, what's the one big thing that really stands out to you?
The Jews' rejection of
all right, the great point would be their not only their rejection of Christ, but the evil of their rejection of Christ. And I say that to let me show you the passage, the part of it that really strikes me. Really, verse 36 and 37. And he sent other servants more than the first, and they did the same to them. And finally he sent his son to them, saying, "They'll respect my son." What strikes me is the length to which God has gone to try to win the hearts of his people and the respect and the devotion of his people. God, if it'd been me, if I owned the land, after the first servant, the deal would have pretty much been finished. How about you? All right. God, however, sent other servants. He did this more than once. And then he even, after they've mistreated all them, he even sends his beloved son. So you see how far God will go here to do this. All right, now let's work our way through the passage here. First off, there was a master of the house or an owner of a vineyard. Who does this? We can allegorize. I think this. Who does this represent?
God.
All right, this is obviously God in this passage here. He's the owner of the vineyard. He's the master of the house. He has the right to expect that what belongs to him will bear fruit for him. He comes looking for fruit. All that is just and so forth. Now, number two, when he plants a vineyard, who does this vineyard represent? All right, what people? All right, this represents the nation of Israel, his covenant people. And notice that he puts a fence around it. He digs a wine press. The fence is to protect it. The wine press is anticipation to the fruit so that the juice could be squeezed out and collected. He builds a tower to protect it from animals or thieves or intruders. And only then does he lease it out to tenants, or does he put it into the authority or the hands of his servants. Now, probably it's important here for us to be aware that Jesus is making use of a great Old Testament picture that all of these people who heard him would have been real well aware of. John, go back to Isaiah chapter 5 for us. Y'all will remember this. Maybe you think of it immediately when I say that. And you can see the advantages that Israel has been given. If you compare this in your mind to Romans chapter 9, the first part, with all of the advantages that Paul said that Israel had been given, it strikes us. John, start at verse 1, read a few verses here.
Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed it out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O Jerusalem, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up.
All right, thanks, John. Now, the only difference in that passage there is that it's the vineyard itself that is the focus, and in Matthew 21, it is the tenants who were put in charge of the vineyard who turn out to be the difference. But the idea that God has a vineyard, that he gave it every advantage, that it should have produced good grapes, but it brought forth possum grapes, that's the point here that allows there to be an image for Jesus to draw from, the connection between Israel and the vineyard and the prophets like that is a picture that's been used before. Now, in this case, he leases it out to vine dressers or to tenants here. And I'm wondering when you look at this, who would you think, if we do attach of a detail or an identity to this, who would these tenants represent?
Prophets.
All right. Possibly the prophets. I'll write the prophets here, of the people. Can you think of others, though?
Sanhedrin.
All right. I think maybe let me just do it this way. I'll just call it the leaders of the people. And I think maybe originally speaking, we would have thought of the priests, the kings, and the prophets. They're the ones who exercise the leadership of God's covenant people and who should have attended to the nation so that it would produce good fruits. But in this case here, think about what Carl has just said. When you get to the end of this passage, what one striking thing happens here that might make this mean exactly what he said?
They are the ones that get angry about what he said.
All right, why do they get angry about it? All right, they saw that he was talking about them. So we'd have to say that the vine dressers in this case extend down to the temple authorities and the religious leaders of the people, the chief priests and the council members, the Sanhedrin members, who ended up taking the lead and trying to, in the effort to destroy Jesus, right? They have to be the embodiment of it right now, at least in this case. Now, who would then be the servants? Servants that are sent by the owner, by the master of the house, to receive the owner's share of the fruit. All right. Now we have the prophets, I think, here. All right, we have here in this case those who are sent from God to deliver His message to the people and to call on the people for covenant faithfulness, which would have been the fruit that we're talking about here. And notice what happens. The prophets tended to get beat up, killed, stoned. Can you think of which ones might fit those categories? And then another, he sends other servants more than the first, and they did the same. And so you see the not only the rejection of God's claim on His people, but the continued rejection over a period of time. If you read 2 Kings 17 or passages like that that come along upon the fall of the nation of Israel, God emphasizes that He sent all His servants, the prophets, and they rejected each one. Now this comes up, if you look over a little bit with me, in chapter 23, and remember this is not separated by much time, maybe a day or so from the telling of this story, but look at Matthew 23 beginning at 29. And think about, and really, I want to read to the end of this chapter, 29 through 39, and think about the way in which this works out here. Barney, do you mind to read Matthew 23 now, verses 29 through 39?
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets.
All right, now hold on for a second there. What kind of an attitude, what kind of a comment is it that they're accustomed to making there? They are keeping the graves of the prophets decorated with flowers and monuments and so forth, and they are saying, if we'd have been there, we wouldn't have done this stuff. All right. Now, go ahead, Barney, verse 31.
Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of your father's guilt. Servants, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, to be murdered between the temple and the altar. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.
All right. Now think about that in the light of our little parable here. Look especially at verse 34 and 35. Who would it turn out to be that he's talking about? Notice that the Lord does not use past tense in verse 35. He uses the present or future. Therefore, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you will kill and crucify, and some you'll flog in the synagogues and persecute from town to town. Who's he talking about there?
It could be the apostles.
It would be. Their fathers have done this with prophets that God sent leading up to Jesus, and they're going to do this with people who are going to be sent by Jesus. Think of some of the servants of Christ that you can think of who in Jerusalem ended up being treated this way.
Stephen
would be the most obvious, the first one. That done by the religious authorities. Who else?
Peter.
All right. Peter ends up being imprisoned in Jerusalem. Who else? You think about
Paul.
All right. James, the Apostle James, who's beheaded by Agrippa. Then, of course, the Apostle Paul. Think about the... Well, we've been the last two or three Sundays, we've been learning from Acts how what lengths, what vitriol he met in Jerusalem when he went up there to take money to try to help the people in their suffering. And you can see the hatefulness in that. So you think of that. All right, now back to our passage in chapter 21 again. It says that finally he sent his son. Who would that be?
Jesus.
All right. That would be Christ. That would be Jesus. And the father is thinking, they'll respect my son. Now, this detail here is, I think, used to provide the power in the story, the impact of the story. God knew how they would treat his son. Christ has been telling his disciples how he was going to be treated and so forth. It was his hope that he would be respected and so forth. The tenants, however, said, this is his heir. Let us kill him and seize his inheritance. Or in this case, I think it would relate to his office or his authority. So the killing him would, of course, end up being the betrayal, the arrest, the trials, and finally his crucifixion, which would occur in just a few days from this period of time. And when they crucified him, then that would be the end of the whole story and everything would go back to normal, right? No. What would happen is that he would then prove to be the stone. And there are two... I meant to leave more time for this part, but there are two passages here that are... where the references are important. Jesus concludes this parable with a question: what will the owner do? And he allowed his hearers to pronounce basically judgment on themselves. And look how they say it, verse 41. He'll put those wretches to a miserable death. Justly so. And then he will let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him fruits. Now, that detail there, what does that refer to? He'll let out his vineyard to other tenants.
Gentiles.
All right, the Gentiles will be given an opportunity to respond to the gospel and to be included in the rule of Christ, which will only further intensify the hatred of the enemies of Christ. But notice in verse 42, the stone that the builders rejected becomes the chief cornerstone. That is a quotation from Psalm 118, verses 22 and 23. And it's a passage that's often made use of in the New Testament to illustrate that Christ is the one from whom all things take their shape. And then verse 44, he mentions that anyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and anyone upon whom this stone falls will be crushed into powder. That statement is a citation from what is it, Isaiah chapter 8, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Isaiah 8, verses 14 and 15. So, again, Jesus is telling the keepers of the Scriptures what the real application of the Scriptures is. Okay, Russ?
I think you can see in Acts and in Galatians that the church parting ways and becoming something separate from Judaism was a difficult and painful process.
Yes.
But you know, to me, this is basically saying that that's going to happen.
I agree. And that's one of the reasons that I say I think this gives an overview of the whole Bible, from the effort God made to have a people to the way God ends up having a separate people made up of individuals from all nations who submit to the rule of Christ. And in that way, this becomes a real thought-provoking thing. Any other things about this passage that stand out to you you'd like to mention before we leave? All right, where do I fit in this story? Some people who heard it there got mad because they thought he was talking about them. God forbid that a preacher would be talking about me.
Hopefully we're the tenants who pay rent.
Hopefully. Let me say it a different way. Hopefully we are people in whose lives good fruit can be found. Isn't that the point? As Russ said, hopefully we're the tenants who pay the rent. That we respond to it in a way that indicates our respect for the fact that the Lord really is the owner of us and of everything we have, and in particularly of His people, which He has gone to such great lengths to establish, to purchase, to be loved by. And hopefully we'll respond to it in that way. All right. Y'all are patient group. We appreciate you being with us. Hope everybody has a good week.